the Minivig Gang podcast for Saturday, September 13th, 2008. Okay, so it's Saturday, September 13th, 2008, another Minivig Gang.
And good morning.
How you doing? On the phone is Phil Wilson, Graham Thickens, and I'm Steve Borsch. And we're going to chat about a number of different things this morning. And really, what I wanted to start off with, though, because I'm dying to hear, because you were on the ground, Graham, your recap of both TechCrunch 50 and Demo.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I've had my fill of startups for the week. I'll tell you that. I think, you know, I mean, if we talk about a fire hose, I did the double fire hose this year. You know, I think between the two events, it was 120 some launches, and I was only at the last day of TechCrunch, so I probably sat through about 85 or 90. And was approached and pitched by others as well. So it's been, I'm OD'd on startups, but gosh, saw a lot of great stuff. Demo was just over the top. I mean, it was fantastic. The best one out of seven I think I've been to. It was the biggest demo fall ever. I didn't get a count on actual attendance, but you know, they always include the, you know, the bus boys and the maintenance people in those counts anyway. So, but I expect it was probably close to 1,000. And I think the press list was more than I expected. It was close to 90, you know, like I always like to say, everybody from Walt Mossberg on down. And I was at the bottom of the list, but I had fun, and I did sit next to Walt and Katie Barrett from the Wall Street Journal. It's always fun to hang out and pretend like you're a journalist, you know?
But, well, you are a journalist.
There were many, many bloggers there. I mean, you know, out of the press list counts on both these events, I'm sure, you know, 70-80% of them were bloggers. But then a lot of the media people are bloggers now too, you know, like Kara Swisher and Walt Mossberg for that matter, you know, are really bloggers too. But Demo, just to wrap it up real quick, Demo was by far and away the better conference, which I knew it would be. I mean, they've been at it for 18 years, twice a year. TechCrunch 50 is their second attempt. It was markedly better than last year from what I've heard. And it pulled more people being in the Bay Area, south of Market. You know, it pulled, they said, close to 1,700. Their Wi-Fi borked on day one. They had huge problems with their Wi-Fi.
I saw that.
A lot of people just left, you know. But they worked all night and fixed it. And you know, the day I was there, I didn't really have any big issues with the Wi-Fi, but I was plugged into the, you know, into the wired network too, in the press rows. But you know, in general there, you know, entrepreneurship is alive and well in the internet space. There are many, many great startups, a lot of Me Too's, a lot of bad presentations, especially at TechCrunch 50. The quality of the demos is and the presentations themselves is markedly different between the two, because I think at Demo there's a lot more coaching that goes on, and it's actually traditionally the companies are hiring professional coaches in many cases, and so the onstage 6 minutes is very well rehearsed at that Demo, and sometimes not so great at TechCrunch 50, although there were some outstanding ones. But I'd say the day I was there, the number of bad presentations outnumbered the good ones as far as I was concerned. So I could go on and on. I don't want to dominate the discussion here, but.
Well, you know what if I could just interject, I found that I watched, I'd say maybe 15 presentations from Demo and TechCrunch 50, and I, you know, Demo clearly, as you said, they've been around for 18 years, and there was more than just you know, internet centric demos and so forth, but a lot of the pitches were just really boring. And I was surprised. I mean, it's you know, in this day and age when there's so much coaching help available for people to be able to learn how to communicate their value propositions and to be able to do so in front of an audience, that there's just really no excuse.
Well, money might be it. I mean, in hard times, and you know, a lot of these startups. I was amazed at the number of startups that had not raised VC yet at Demo, because typically you'll see a half or two-thirds that have already raised some, you know, well, significant angel funding, if not a Series A. I couldn't believe that it seemed like the majority said just privately funded or self-funded. I couldn't believe it. So I think we had a lot of startups at both events that don't have a lot of coin. And to hire these professional coaches does get kind of pricey. I mean, you know, the fee, first of all, to present and go through the demo process is what you're paying for, is $18,500. And typically,
the point of contention between those two events.
Right. Which I think is largely, you know, bunk. You know, because you get what you pay for, you know. On top of that, demo firms, many of them, and I would say most of them, also hire a PR firm to help them manage the 2 or 3 month process to get ready for demo and to get ready to hype the company and the post hype. And that, you know, Bay Area prices on that can be easily $10,000 to $15,000 a month. You know, so many companies are spending $30,000-$50,000 or more on PR support on top of that $18,500. And I dare say they're getting, the ones that do it right are getting a very good return on that investment. But on top of that, companies will pay a coach, you know, $5,000-$10,000 at least on top of that sometimes. So, you know, perhaps this year's crop didn't have the scratch to go and hire these professional coaches as much as in maybe past years.
Graham and Steve, maybe you guys should shed a little light on Demo, as far as, you know, I think that most that are listening to us know what Demo is, but perhaps you could talk a little bit about really the impact. You're talking about a fairly significant amount of money being spent and time being spent to roll out a piece of product in, what, 6 minutes. Tell me, does Demo represent a tipping point for a lot of these startups? Is it really a strong key factor in success?
I sure think so. Absolutely, because of the visibility, it's amazing.
It brings a amount of visibility, and it's got, you know, it's got that reputation and that cred with the media. The media takes Demo very, very seriously. And companies get big play out of Demo. And again, you're competing with, in this case, 72 companies are competing with each other to get the attention of the media. So it's in addition to preparing and hiring a good PR firm and so forth to get ready for this moment in time, this, you know, kind of one day one they get at Demo, they have to figure out, okay, how am I going to compete against these other 70 to get attention at Demo? And, you know, you see companies do really interesting stuff. One outfit, which is a unit of Advanta, the big credit card company or whatever they are, bank, I don't know, I guess they are in Philly, has a new venture called bizequity.com, where you can go online and find out the valuation of any small business. And you can get a custom valuation of your own small business. They all showed up dressed like small business people, you know, and at the opening party, they all had these funky outfits on. The lead guy was dressed up as a pizza guy, you know, with the hat.
I saw that picture.
Apron. Yeah. And I thought, okay, you're standing out. I noticed you. And you know, so it's dog eat dog out there. I mean, the PR people are all over the media, but in a nice way. You know, I mean, there are many, many, many great PR people that help clients manage demo every year. Some have multiple clients there at a time. I mean, I talked to one company that between the two events, Demo and TechCrunch 50, they had 7 clients. And it's not a particularly big PR firm, but it's a, you know, Bay Area-based tech PR firm. And so I know a lot of these people, and they always come and find me. And, you know, and you get to the opening party, and you know, the pitches start flowing. Or, here, I want you to meet the CEO, you know. But it's a wonderful networking experience, and the people are great, and the show people are in the background, and the logistics behind that show are incredible. And I just want to give a hat tip too to Evergreen, the outfit that's the crew that actually puts the show on, as far as all the backstage guys. Absolutely awesome. And I couldn't believe it. They came out and did you see my tweet about, it's in my Flickr pics too. They came out and did a dance in the dark up on stage, holding flashlights with red lenses on the end. And they did, you know, like a choreographed dance to some funky, you know, music. Anyway, I tweeted it and said, you know, they're fantastic. These guys do an absolutely incredible job. They're the best production company I know. The guy tweeted me back and thanked me.
Oh, that's fantastic.
I couldn't believe it. He's on backstage. He's on Twitter.
Okay, so here's the question for you, Graham. One of the things that VCs talked about a lot and others at various conferences I've been to, whether it's been eTech or the Web 2.0 Expo and so on, all about the fundamental shift in sort of base level open source offerings, whether it's MySQL or PHP and all of the tools being used to develop that are in open source and so on, that it's really changed the cost equation of being able to be a startup. And would you say that, based on how you had brought up that a lot of these were not funded, hadn't even gone through a Series A round yet, that maybe this was the tipping point? Maybe this was the first real true manifestation of companies that are launching in a real very serious way, and a lot of them based on that new cost equation?
Yeah, I think it may have been, because I didn't go through and count, but I could. I could go through the demo book, because they post that or state that right in the descriptions of the companies, what their funding is, at least the statement of whether it's private or self-funded. And in many cases, they will state dollar amounts depending on what the company wants to say. But I, from my casual observation, I would say that the majority of the companies were not very funded at all, or they would have said. In other words, it seems to me that companies that have raised 500K or a million are always going to state that, you know, whereas the ones that haven't don't say anything, you know. I mean, if they've only raised a few hundred thousand, they're not even going to mention it. But yes, I would say, having been to many demos, that this was the first one I've noticed where it seemed most of the companies were in that category of very thin funding, because companies, certainly web-based companies these days, don't need much money to get going and to prove some milestones and then get out there and start talking at events like demo.
So let's ask, you know, right out front, how did our Minnesota companies do?
Well, companies, it was just Best Buy.
I think there was just Best Buy, now that I think about it. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. Unfortunately, our only representative this year, and not that we ever have a lot of representatives, but the only representative from the upper Midwest states was Giftag from Best Buy, and they did great. Gary Kelling and Steve Bent, and they had a developer along with them whose name is escaping me right now. He did well on stage too. All the three of them took the stage, did a very good job describing their wish list service called Giftag, which is based on micro formats, a coming standard. And And what was the other? Oh, you know, yeah, they do have open APIs as well. So it's kind of an interesting play that fits into the social shopping space, which is getting to be quite an interesting space with some other players out there as well that have one at least that's already been acquired. So yeah, I thought they did well. I was going to blog about it, didn't have a chance to. I tweeted about it, but I think they generally were real happy. I asked them several times if they were getting into a lot of good discussions, and they said yes, they were. I don't know if they were seeking to do any partnerships. I don't know exactly what their objectives might have been at the show, but they really did seem to be happy with the way things went.
Well, you know, what's interesting is I've had two conversations about GiftTag with clients, and there was some head scratching about Best Buy doing a wish list across the web that had something to do or didn't have anything to do with some of the products they carry, sort of this generic wish list creator. And I looked at them both in different meetings with this quizzical look and said, yeah, but imagine if you had visibility into wish lists and trends of what people were asking others to buy for them or what they wanted to buy, how incredibly powerful that would be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think if this micro formats thing takes off, and I think that's the big question with GiftTag, it could, you know, open up a world of possibilities. And so they're obviously betting on that. I didn't really get a chance to ask these guys what their ultimate game plan is here. Are they totally going to spin this out from Best Buy? Are they going to ramp it up? Are they going to get funding internally to add more people, or is this just kind of an experiment, a wait and see kind of a thing, waiting for micro formats to get adopted widely, you know?
Well, if you'd like to join me, I have a tentative interview set up for Wednesday.
Oh,
with Gary and Steve and Cameron. So,
Cam Gross.
Yeah. So I'm happy to have you join.
Yeah, Cam's a good guy. He wasn't at demo, but yeah, I might be able to join you for that. We'll see how things go.
Okay. Well, listen. I want to do a quick segue into something that we got a couple of more topics to go here, but.
Steve, just before you hop off, though, why don't you go ahead and post the link to GiftTag's presentation at demo? I shot that to you, so you might want to post that in the show notes.
Thanks.
You bet.
We'll do. One of the themes that's run through many of the interviews that we've done on Minovate with startups in Minnesota is that one of the fundamentals is broadband and access. And of course, we know that the state of Minnesota has that ultra high speed broadband task force, and Governor Pawlenty signed that SF 1918 into law, mandating the task force that our friend Mike O'Connor is on. But what's interesting, and here's a call out to anyone who's listening to this, that on September 16th, on Tuesday, there's going to be a full committee meeting at the Minnesota State Senate on why broadband matters. And they're going to receive testimony regarding the consumer benefits of broadband service in areas like education, job opportunities, telemedicine, and access to government resources. So if anybody would like to attend that meeting, I'll put something in the show notes in terms of where that's at and so forth. Really wanted to get that out there. The other topic that I wanted to kind of get into a little bit is your reaction to something that I found to be incredibly useful. I haven't purchased it, but it's a application that allows you to search for, look up, and download podcasts. It's a little iPhone application. And there's a big row going on right now because Apple said that duplicated functionality available in iTunes, and they disallowed it being sold on the App Store.
Well, they yanked it, huh?
They rejected it. They didn't yank it.
Oh, they never let it on.
They never let it on in the first place. And I looked at that and found that to be extremely useful, because there's many, many times when I realize I haven't synced my iPhone to iTunes, and now I'm bothered because, boy, I sure would love to go download the latest podcast from, you know, This Week in Tech or you know, the Social Conversations from Stanford or whatever it happens to be.
Or Minovate Gang.
Or Minovate Gang. Yeah, there you go. So I just wonder what your reaction is.
Well, you know, Apple controls what happens in the App Store, and if they feel like it's violating the terms of service, and I'm sure if you read the terms of service or whatever they call it, the NDA, or the developer agreement, I guess is a better term, you know, it probably says any app that infringes on an Apple offering or something like that, we reserve the right to, you know, disallow. And you know, what are you going to do? I mean, he who holds the gold rules, you know, and there are many stories. We got our own sob story at Duap, my employer, about an app that wasn't allowed on the store. And that's all well and good, but we have to wait like 6 weeks to get the rejection, you know. Was insane, especially when we had five other apps up on the store, and it's like, why aren't you telling us about number six, you know? And well, you know, the whoopee cushion, you guys know the story. Yeah. And you know, we continue to get emails, oh, Apple should let that on, you know. The reason was, you know, community standards worldwide, you know, in other countries. But you know, people are saying, well, okay, let it be used in the US then, you know. Everybody gets the joke, you know. So you know, what are you going to do? I mean, a podcast directory service like that would be wonderful, but there are many apps going begging that won't be let on the store for various reasons, unfortunately.
Well, I think you got to look at it also that nowhere along the line of the development and the introduction and the rollout and the growth of the iPhone does it say, hey, we're open source. They're not. It's an app. It's Apple, you know, and clearly the iPhone and like much of what Apple does is, you know, sets a standard, sets a trend, becomes part of our culture. And the cost of admission to that is playing by their rules. If you want to be part of it, you just have to play by their rules, as frustrating as it may be, because the people that truly appreciate things that Apple does and produces are those same people that are passionate about making sure that everybody has a chance to share whatever's out there. And they're not necessarily compatible. And but at the same time, you have to remember that Apple is what it is and has become what it's become because they've been successful at the way they do things. And if you may not agree with one piece, you really have to look at the overall picture and say, you know, it all seems to have come together and worked to the point where that's the place to be and that's the way it is.
Yeah, you know, though, and it is a push-pull, and we're not sitting in all of these meetings, and we're not doing what Apple's doing, which is dealing with carriers worldwide who heretofore have had unbelievable draconian control over the networks. But at the same time, there's nothing that kills an ecosystem faster than draconian control. And so how do you balance, and I'm sure that Apple, I mean, they're obviously trying to balance the engagement with the carriers and trying to get this platform to be wildly successful, and yet they're just, you know, they don't use social media. I mean, the mobile me blog has no name attached to it. I mean, there's no human face to it, and so there's no conversation, there's no dialogue, there's no one saying, look, you just need to understand that this is a different universe that we're living in, that we're playing in. It's not like we're delivering a laptop, you know, and anyone can write an app for it. This is I did some work for Palm 2 years ago. I wrote a white paper for the penetration of the higher ed market, and I gained an incredible appreciation for what Palm had to deal with the carriers, the length of time it took to get handsets accepted, the sorts of apps that could and could not run on the network. It was an incredible challenge and very, very difficult. So while I appreciate that, I also understand that, you know, there are people that are app developers that are just simply mad.
Well, I think that it's kind of interesting, and maybe it sounds a little cynical, but you talked about what can hurt an ecosystem. I don't know. I always kind of harken back to the fact that as much as I love Apple and as much as they're a very cult-like company, they're a company. This is a business, not an ecosystem necessarily. So, I mean, I know where you're coming from, Steve. I completely agree with you. But at the same time, you kind of balance that with what are the ultimate goals of Apple, and that's the success of their products. And they're looking for those apps and those things that can make their product more successful. And at the same time, not damage perhaps another product that they own.
Well, and let's remember that the developers are supposed to be doing this for business reasons too, and this is a remarkable way for them to make money. Excuse me. The 30% that Apple takes is a bargain. I mean, to get into this distribution channel. So what these guys are doing, these developers are supposed to be coming up with, with apps that are going to sell and make them a profit. So that's what this is really about. And you have to remember that it isn't just a place for, hackers to load stuff up and have fun and put anything up there that they want to. It has to be done by the rules. And the ultimate objective is to make money, which Apple certainly is doing and which developers are certainly doing. And it's been documented, examples of what kind of money these people are making, what kind of downloads they're getting.
Well, Graham, do you have an opportunity as an app developer to submit your concept and get it approved before you go and do the development? Or is it the other way around? You actually do the development and submit the app?
Unfortunately, it's the latter.
Ouch.
I really don't think there's any mechanism at all. This is a very good point you're bringing up, Steve. I don't think there's any mechanism at all to feel them out, to submit a concept and get approval for it in advance. If there is, no one's ever told me.
That would just be crushing. I mean, to go through all the effort to create the app and then have it rejected.
Well, again, I would say, read the darn developer agreement. It's not that hard to read. It's 20 or 30 pages long, but it's written in very simple English. And, it's not, all caps, with no leading like the typical legal document. I question whether a lot of these guys ever read the darn thing before they just went off and started developing. You have to know what you're getting into. But it would be nice if they had some way to get a concept approved. But I just don't think Apple has time for that. I mean, the number of apps backed up waiting to get in. I haven't read a recent figure, but I heard, it's got to be 7-8 weeks ago now. It was 4,000 apps were backed up waiting to get in.
Oh, my gosh.
I can't even imagine what that number must be now. I mean, Apple has finite resources. I mean, as big as they are, they can still only review and approve these things so quickly. And I got to think that's improving, but because they're getting better at it or putting more people on it. But then again, the number of apps flying at them, the number of, I don't know if they're adding more approved, if they're approving more developers into the program. I certainly expect that they are. But in addition to that, individual developers are coming up with more and more apps themselves. I mean, we have a pipeline of easily 8 or 10 that are, fairly close to being ready to be submitted. In stages over the next several weeks. I don't talk to that many other developers to find out how many they have coming, but I expect that as they get better at it, they're submitting more and more. And what's really painful is not knowing how long it's going to take them to look at them, It's all over the board. We've had new apps and updates. And you have to remember, developers are submitting updates all the time. Those have to get approved, reviewed, and approved. So, and many developers are submitting updates, get this, just to get up at the top of the list, you know, like most recent, you know, how the iTunes App Store ranked different ways, and you can look at a given category and see most recent. Well, some developers are submitting updates just to get to the top of that list. So they'll be up at the top when people look at most recent. Oh, it's crazy. I mean, it's, it is. It's every man for himself. And I mean, if you get on that approved list, if you're lucky enough to be an approved developer and start submitting stuff, and, you know, and then you get with the program, you just keep submitting like mad, and Apple's trying to review them as fast as they can. And they hit 100 million downloads, as I'm sure you all heard at the Let's Rock event. I predicted that was coming. So onward and upward, and DoApp is well north of 2.5 million, I'm sure now.
Well,
ourselves.
Yep. Well, one other thing I'd like to chat about today before we end the show is something that has been seemingly accelerating, and I don't know if you're seeing this also as a trend, but I'll give you just one example. I'm going to be writing an article next week on the University of Minnesota and Eden Prairie High School, where my son is a ninth grader, using Moodle, the open source learning management system. And what's interesting about this at the district level is that the district has not been an adopter at all in any way, shape, or form of open source software. And I've got a call scheduled with the fellow that runs the technology, operational and educational technology at Eden Prairie District about the adoption of it. And the U of M has done a tremendous amount with it. In fact, they've moved away from WebCT that got bought by Blackboard and gone open source. And so that, coupled with 2 weeks ago talking with Dries Butart by Skype, he's the founder of Drupal, and he also, they've created a for-profit company called Acquia that will be the commercial support arm for Drupal. And they're going to offer distributions and themes, and they're going to service and support it. They're going to be going after some specific target markets. I talked to the VP of marketing yesterday about their plans. And it's almost as though I can't turn around now without seeing adoptions happening. And because, of course, I'm looking for it. Are you seeing those same sorts of things? Are you running into more choices being made in open source than being made in commercial software? I know that's a sweeping generalization type question, but
I guess, yeah. I mean, I would generally say I'm seeing, I don't know if I'm seeing more than commercial, but I'm seeing more and more open source. You know, who isn't, you know?
Yeah. I think WordPress is one example of all of the even enterprise blogs that are running on WordPress. Versus movable type as an example, the commercial distribution of movable type.
Yep, absolutely.
Okay.
Hey, on the subject of online learning, Steve, I just have to mention a TechCrunch 50 presenter called Grokket, which is a massive multiplayer online learning game. So, you know, we're hearing about online learning out there. It's you might want to look at Grokket.com.
Hey, let me ask you guys this, something a little bit more general and sweeping here as far as it goes, as education goes and quote unquote interactive or new media. Do you feel that there's enough attention being paid to, educating kids on what is out there in the world of online, you know, the concept of, yeah, everybody knows how to do text messaging, but is there anybody that teaches anything as far as familiarizing yourself with email or, online etiquette or anything like that? Do you know, is that being incorporated into curriculums anywhere?
Oh, man, I got to jump in on this one. First of all, the answer is no. At Central Middle School here in Eden Prairie, and I know that we're atypical because Eden Prairie is one of the top, most robust demographics, and have enough funds to do a lot of different things. And having the teachers get extremely excited about the new technology in the classroom that they had this year, which was last year, and it was projectors in the ceiling. So they didn't have to roll carts in. They actually had projectors in the ceiling. And several of the teachers were extremely excited about that. Well, so, you know, and they have problems now in Eden Prairie High School with kids using their cell phones to text message one another and also to text message answers and also with smartphones to be using Wikipedia or, you know, some online, you know, CIA World Factbook or whatever to be able to look up answers during tests. So there's a great concern about the kids' cutting edge ability to do sort of subversive technology use because they're way ahead of the teachers and they're way ahead of the administrators with respect to adopting technology. Here's what did concern me, though. My son took a test last year, the Science Minnesota Comprehensive Assessment, and it's not part of the state accountability system with No Child Left Behind, that whole federal program, but the state of Minnesota science standards are grade banded, so every district has to be able to teach these certain kinds of concepts. So I look at my son's results, and he's just at the line between partially meets the standard and meets the standard. And then there's this huge gap up above which says exceeds the standard. And I'm talking to him about it. And he looks and he goes, well, wait a minute, Dad. I did better than the school, the district, and the state. So the state isn't even partially meeting the standard. I don't know what the criteria is fully. I really haven't investigated this. We just got this yesterday. But this brings up, to answer your question, Phil, or with respect to education and all of that, I think that the biggest issue is the conceptual stuff that maybe isn't being taught. You know, the kids are learning these devices and they're playing online and they're doing online games. And that's why I was interested in Grokket, because I do think that, you know, being able to do successive iterations of stuff without any penalty is a great way to learn, because you really do quickly grasp something, or Grokket. But I have great concern over the lack of mastery of fundamentals, you know, specifically in science.
I agree. It's one of those things that I had sent an email off to my sons, and this, you know, I blogged about this at RemainCom, which is, you know, that's all about communication. And, you know, when I sent an email off to my son's communication teacher last year and asked her, you know, is there a unit of study where you talk about email etiquette, understanding what you should keep private, what you shouldn't keep private online? Is there even something as simple as, you know, basic blogging 101? I mean, and Steve, you and I have talked about this before, that there's a fundamental difference between how you talk by a text message or instant message and how you write or talk in maybe a letter or an email or the way you would write a story. I mean, there are different ways to communicate in different mediums. And I don't know, I got back from her, no, I don't have anything like that. That sounds fantastic. And of course, nothing ever happened about it. But, you know, I can't blame teachers for that. They got a lot going on. But, it seems to me that there's a real need for us, those people that completely, but work at understanding how things work in the virtual space. I think that there's a need for us to educate kids as they start to grapple with it.
Well, so here's Steve Borsch's worthless opinion, maybe, but yesterday I did a post about web content container companies on my own blog about, hey, we'd like to be able to make some money too. So YouTube and Acrobat.com and Sprout Builder and the new Flowgram are all ways that these companies want to have us create content so they can build critical mass of eyeballs and then, of course, sell advertising around it. Hey, but what about us? I want to make some money on the content I produce, right? Well, so I have been thinking a lot about Flowgram, which really hit my radar screen yesterday. And what it is, and I'll put links in the show notes, is it's a way to pull in any web page, PowerPoint, photos, voice, notes. You can highlight stuff. You can share it, you know, obviously embed your creation elsewhere. But what I realized is this is the type of thing that is being developed that our kids are going to completely get. And here's where I'm going with this. It's all about multiple inputs. It's all about taking in more things, processing them, compartmentalizing them, or connecting dots and being able to move to the next thing. So I have talked to my daughter about this because she communicates sometimes with six or eight people. You know, we the four of us go out to dinner, her mom and brother and I, and she'll be text messaging and, well, yeah, that was so-and-so, or that was so-and-so, or that was so-and-so. And it's just these quick little snippets of messages. And I asked her, I said, how come you don't pick up the phone and just call them? She goes, Dad, because it takes too long. And plus, I don't know if they're busy or I don't know what. So she's able, while we're having dinner, to really not be completely interrupted by a phone call, but she's able to text. So she's able to communicate, you know, with half a dozen people while we're having dinner. And so that's kind of the trend that I'm seeing, is the ability to take in and synthesize just a huge number of inputs, significantly more than we have been able to bring in. But then that brings up the issue of, Are kids going to be able to be contemplative? Are they going to be able to sit back and say, well, wait a minute. I got to let this sink in. I've got to process it. I've got to internalize it. I've got to mull it over. I've got to see what's real, what's not real, rather than say, as long as it's here, I'll just take it on face value. I'm more worried about the lack of critical thinking skills than I am about the technology.
Agreed, and that's the issue that I see here. And you said that you know, this is the, when you were talking about Flowgram, you talked about, you know, this is something that our kids will you know, be all about. They'll use it a lot. My concern is that some of them won't be able to benefit from some of these great technologies because they haven't been exposed to it, you know, with their peers at school or something like that, or their parents don't understand it, so they don't pass it along. I think that what there doesn't seem to be any logical way of educating our kids as to what is out there and what is available. Many people still don't grasp MySpace. They still don't grasp, you know, basic, what we would consider rudimentary social media, you know. And I think it's important that there be some way of educating our kids on that and educating them with the I don't know, what do you want to consider right or wrong, but, you know, especially when it comes to online safety, there's that sort of thing. I don't think it's being addressed.
Yeah, I think that's true to a great degree. I mean, it's I know with my son, you know, 13 years old, he's interested in girls. And so
the heck you say,
I have extraordinarily strict parental controls set up on his machine upstairs. And he is constantly hammering on me that, Dad, could you please add this website? And I say, no, I'm going to actually go and look at the website first, go through it and make sure that there's not anything you can get access to, because I've caught him a few times. Well, then I got it, you know, I gave him my old iPhone and I was laying in bed the night that I gave it to him and we got it set up, and I thought, oh man, he's got access to the browser. Well, so I went to sleep next morning. I got up, didn't think about it. And then at the end of the day, he came home and I came home and I asked him for his iPhone. He goes, why? I go, I just want to take a quick peek at it. And I looked at the history in the browser and sure as hell he was out. So I took the browser off. He doesn't have a browser on it right now. And so it's unfortunately, most other parents that we know have machines in the family room. They have their computers where they can have, you know, it's in a public place where the kids can access things. He has one in his bedroom because it's there all the time and he's managing his music and his videos and everything else. But I am in the, you know, fortunate position where, you know, I can allow or disallow applications. I mean, I've got the whole thing set up, the Mac OS X Leopard parental controls is just absolutely awesome. But I have to stay on top of it. I mean, I really have to stay on top of it because this kid is, he's gonna hack his way into who knows where, because he can figure stuff out. And so I'm more concerned about that and the stuff that parents don't even know could potentially happen. It's almost as though the training and the education needs to happen at the parental level rather than at the kid level, because the kids are, I mean, they're going to hang with their buddies or their girlfriends, and they're going to figure stuff out, and they don't need us. You know, we need each other.
No, but I completely understand that, and I'm sure they'll be able to figure it out, and you know, hey, they'll learn it on the street. But I think that we know, those of us who have been through the education system know that it's good that they are learning on the street, or hearing about it on the street, but really to completely understand it logically and to really be, you know, thoughtful about it, I think we need to teach it. I mean, you could put that and compare it to sex education if you wanted to. Yes, you can learn it on the street, but really to practice it safely, you really ought to be educated on it. So I guess that's probably what I'm digging at, that I would love to be able to see, you know, people understanding the different nuances of social media or just internet access in general.
Well, you know, this could be, let's move away from this only because this could be an interesting interview to hold on a Minovate call, is to actually talk to somebody in charge of K-12 education in the state of Minnesota with respect to technology. I don't know who that would be, but to get a different perspective on it, which brings up the fact, we won't say who it's going to be, but we're going to be having some special guests coming up, thanks to you.
Oh, I think we can say who it's going to be.
Okay, go ahead.
A few people. So, you did the last week. We were chatting after the Minovate Gang podcast, and we said, you know, let's get some folks in, and we talked about a topic of innovation and media, and more specifically, how does the media, at traditional or mainstream media, cover innovation? And I think those of us those listening to Minovate podcast or watching Minovate website are very much interested in how to either get their startup going or get more information about innovation in Minnesota. So we've gathered a bunch of folks together to chat about that from what you would consider traditional media. Julio
Ojeda Zapata
is going to join us from the Pioneer Press. We've also talked to Catherine Grayson, who is the tech writer for the Minneapolis St. Paul Business Journal, and John Gordon from Future Tense will be joining us next week for a conversation, and looking to secure at least one more participant.
Fabulous. Fabulous.
Thomas Lee at the Tribune would be the guy. You should try it. We should try to get Thomas in on that too, because he's covering innovation, early stage companies quite well for the Tribune.
Fabulous. Well, good. Hey, guys, this has been great. Thanks for your input today. And you have
one last thing.
Yeah.
One last, Steve. We can't let this podcast go by without giving a hat tip to the Minnesota Cup competition.
Oh, man, yes.
Unfortunately, I missed the final reception where they announced the winners on the night of the 11th. I was flying back from San Francisco to San Diego that day, and I'm staying here at San Clemente through the weekend. But we saw the announcement come through here recently, just yesterday, I believe, about who the winners were. Core Spine Technologies got first place and won $50,000. Second winner, My Wonderful Life, got $10,000. Third place winner, Clotus Foods, Fiber and Beyond, got $5,000. And the runners up were Barrier One, which is a security appliance, Willcraft, an amphibious drivable ice fishing shelter. Woo wee, go Minnesota. And the student winner was Zipnosis, which you can read about at MinnesotaCup.com. So they had a tremendous year. Actually, it's MinnesotaCup.org, I guess.
Yeah, I'll put it in the show notes.
They had a tremendous year. 850 applicants are in that neighborhood somewhere, biggest ever. And sorry I missed it. It was a great event last year. I caught it. But unfortunately, they hold it the week of demo. And this year, with TechCrunch 50, it's just a startup. Somebody ought to name it National Startup Week, I guess. Maybe that could be a final act of President Bush, you know?
There we go.
But we don't want to get into politics, please.
No.
Free zone.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Well, good. I'll put something in the show notes about and link to the Minnesota Cup info. Thanks for bringing that up.
You bet.
All right. Well, have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you soon. Mm-hmm.